You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
I'm going to move to our next presentation, which is going to be by Beena Agarwal. Beena will be talking about the dynamics and impact of women's participation in community forestry in South Asia, focusing on her field research in India and Nepal. Yes,
thank you.
Beena, you have the floor.
I don't know if you can actually see any of the slides. I had a hard time yesterday. In any case, I have a few hard copies of my paper. I didn't post them on the paper online. So after the presentation, if anybody is really provoked, you could come and take a copy. Now, as we saw yesterday, the concept of social and solidarity economy is still evolving and is contentious. And there is a great deal that is being claimed on its behalf. But there appears to be a convergence in conceptualizing it as constituted of various forms of citizens' associations, social movements, self-help groups, and so on, which cooperate for production and exchange in inclusive ways, possibly ethical ways, and interact with outside institutions such as state and markets on behalf of citizens. Now, some also present SSC as an alternative to capitalist forms of development, as Suzanne's own position was. But however we define it, these descriptions of SSC are of groups which are interacting with institutions outside the groups, rather than about intra-group dynamics. Yet clearly, intra-group dynamics can impinge centrally on successful cooperation within the group, as well as the group's effectiveness in its engagement with extra group institutions. So what I do in the paper is I focus particularly on within group dynamics as predicated on gender and class, and I examine the effect of a group's gender composition on its ability, on the ability of women to participate effectively in local institutions of environmental governance and the impact of their participation. I also then examine how the groups might be scaled up to strengthen their bargaining power with the state. Now, that the social composition of governance groups matters has long been stressed for equity and for inclusion, but we might ask, does it also matter for effective functioning? Can simply increasing women's numbers, raising their proportions, make a difference, as is implied by all the lobbying that's been going on in gender quotas in parliament to village councils? Or is it something more that is needed for effectiveness, such as shared values and ideologies? What I argue is that in given contexts, simply the inclusion of larger numbers, I call it the power of numbers, simply increasing the larger numbers of women can raise, and raising their proportions in mixed gender groups, what I call women in themselves, can go a long way in improving outcomes, even without a thrust to create a women for themselves social consciousness, although efforts may be made to shift towards the latter. And I use as an example my work on community forestry groups in South Asia to demonstrate how increasing the proportion of women representatives in the key body, like the executive committee of these institutions, how that would enhance both women's effective participation as well as institutional outcomes. And I also try and measure critical mass. It's a concept which has been long mooted but very little empirically tested. And I base this on primary surveys that I undertook in India and Nepal, both quantitative and qualitative. I then go on to discuss the whole concept of federations as a way of enhancing the effectiveness of groups, both horizontally and vertically. So the results that I present are summarized. It's a summary of analysis, which is part of my book, Gender and Green Governance, that I'll also be talking about this in the book presentation. And essentially, I'll first talk about some conceptual questions, and then I'll give you some of the results. I'll summarize the results, and then I'll talk about how do we actually talk about enhancing women's numbers and voices in both in local institutions and then vertically. Now, the three conceptual issues that I plan to take up, and I'm sure there could be many more, one is the question of critical mass. The second, I talk about what I term as hierarchical heterogeneity. And the third is implicit versus explicit interests. Now, the whole issue of critical mass, basically what it means is that the presence of other women enables individual women to negotiate conservative social norms and personal reticence. Now, what percentage is a critical mass? And there's a huge debate about this. You know, you start off from Catherine Cantor, who talks about business and corporations, where she says 15% is nominal presence and you need to move towards parity. There are a whole range of other scholars who talk about anything between 50 to 50%, but most of the lobbying has been for one third. The fact is that much of this is ad hoc and there has been rather little empirical testing. So we'll look at what I come out with in terms of critical mass. The concept of hierarchical heterogeneity, however, has been talked about in a whole range of ways, both in the gender literature as well as in the environmental literature, although twain have never met. I separate it from the idea of heterogeneity because not all heterogeneity is necessarily hierarchical. Social and economic hierarchy among women, rich and poor, people of different caste groups, for instance, can lead to conflicting interests. Now, I argue that these interests can either be, this conflict can be a weak conflict or it can be a strong conflict. A weak conflict can be that if you're interested in the same thing, but you have less, you're less propelled. So, for instance, you can have rich and poor women in rural areas who collect firewood, but because rich women may have some family land, they are less dependent on the local forest than poor women. So you have an implicit weak conflict, but not a strong conflict. But I also argue that despite aspects of difference, class and other differences and possibilities of conflict, there are also areas of shared interest among women. And these shared interests can arise from a range of things, particularly, of course, the gender division of labor, the responsibility for a care economy that Suzanne also referred to, the care for children and the elderly, which irrespective of which class you belong to, the responsibility tends to fall on women. And there are certain tasks, for instance, especially in the rural areas, if you look at Asia, especially South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, certain tasks like water fetching, firewood fetching are typically done by women, and you rarely have other labor doing that. So you could have a shared interest and therefore a shared strategic cooperation despite hierarchical heterogeneity. And then there is the question of implicit versus explicit interest. Now, one can argue that if you have a common division of labor and all women may have an interest in having more men share that labor, for instance, or more men take on care economy work. There is an implicit interest. So if you have a group of women, say in a village council or in a community forestry group, they are women in themselves, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are consciously collaborating with each other on the basis of gender. And the shift from that to an explicit form of interest would be if they consciously share an identity, women for themselves. Now, those of you who are familiar with George Lucas's work on history and class consciousness will recognize the concept of class in itself and class for itself, which he used, and this is somewhat analogous to that, except that I eschew the idea of false consciousness. I do not believe that women moving in themselves to for themselves is necessary. The absence of that movement has much to do with false consciousness, but rather to do with the possibilities of them, there are all kinds of other divisions which might prevent you from doing that. So, okay, those are the conceptual parts. Now, what I do in my empirical part of the paper is that I look at 135 community forestry groups in India and Nepal, and I select in Western India, in Gujarat, in Western India, three districts, in which I compare groups which have less than or equal to two women in the executive committee. An executive committee typically can have from anything from 9 to 15 people to those which have more than two women. And this division is because that's the less two women is the mandate. In the case of Nepal, I compare three categories. In addition to these two, also all women's groups, because Nepal has a fair number of all women's groups. And this is, for those who are not familiar with the geography of India, you can see there's Nepal or South Asia. You can see the two colored parts, Nepal on the top and Gujarat in the western side. Now, what are my results? In the context of participation, what I find is that the higher the percentage of women in mixed gender groups, the greater is the likelihood that women attend meetings, they speak up at them, and they hold office. Participation is a really complex concept. It is not just about being a member. It's also about being able to influence the decisions of the group. And what I find, for instance, in attending meetings, and there's, I control for a whole range of factors, you know, in terms of doing regression analysis, which I won't bore you with. But what I find, interestingly, is that executive committees, which have between more than 25 to up to 33% women compared to those who have less than 25% women, have significantly fewer meetings with no women present. This is also the range within which you find a significantly greater likelihood of women attending meetings. And so, although I began with the skeptical idea that, well, is one-third a magic number, I actually find, and those who are lobbying for one-third will take heart from this, that it isn't. It's actually where I find the numbers lie. Similarly, for speaking up, you find that the likelihood of at least one woman speaking up is greater if there are more than one-third women. For instance, in the Indian context, in the Indian sample, the likelihood of at least one woman speaking up was 48% greater in executive committees with more than one-third women. And similarly for office bearing. Now, office bearing is a rather interesting thing to look at, because in the Indian context, irrespective of what proportion of women there are in the executive committee, they don't break the glass ceiling. So you don't actually have women as presidents or as secretaries or treasurers, very, very rarely. But in the case of Nepal, when you actually break the glass ceiling, it's very interesting that you can actually see a critical mass. And that lies around 25%. That is the point at which, at that level, you begin to see that the likelihood of women becoming office wearers increases in a notable way and goes on until it's parity. And after that, it declines. So these would give, as I said, heart to some of these results. But what is also very interesting is that the larger the proportion of landless women in these groups, the greater the likelihood of them attending meetings, speaking up, and not necessarily holding office. But this is something which is often referred to in the feminist literature, that if you have if you are poor and you're disadvantaged, you are at the bottom of the pyramid. And interestingly, that's not the case. What you find is that if you're disadvantaged and you're compelled by need, you not only attend meetings but you actually speak up. Now, this is just a slide. Those who can see it might. My question is, can you really spot the women? This is a meeting in place, and if you see the little red bits, those are the two women in this committee. And the women are saying, well, men don't stop us from speaking, but they do all the talking. the women themselves recognize. Let's take 2 minutes. Push. So I'll go much faster on the results and go to two other elements of the result, which are interesting. One is that not only do women participate more if they are there in critical mass numbers, but also that their presence has significant positive impact on forest condition. And this is so in committees which have more than two women, in the case of Gujarat, which is the India sample, and in all women's groups compared with groups which have some men. Interestingly, all women groups, there's a 51% greater likelihood of forest condition improving compared to groups which have some men in them. And this is again, something which has actually not been measured before, and it becomes an important element of an argument of why it is important, beyond equity, why it is important to enhance the presence of women in governance. And then there's a question of firewood shortages. This is used as a proxy for gender equality, because firewood is the single most important source of fuel in large parts of the developing world, rural world, and women spend huge amounts of time collecting firewood. So most of my sample, they report firewood shortages. But then the question was, does their presence in the executive committee make a difference to the shortages? And I find, in fact, that it does indeed. The villages where in the committees where women are present, they're able to argue for greater extraction of firewood, whether it's number of times in the year, the number of days each time the forest is opened, and so on. So may I ask for a couple of extra minutes and then I'll go to the last part. At this point, let me just summarize the conclusion so far, that the more women there are in the executive committee, the more likely are they to participate. There is a critical mass which lies between 25% to 33% of attending meetings and more than 33% for speaking up. But the presence of EC women is not sufficient for them holding office. For that, you do need to break the glass ceiling. And then women's class position does matter, but not in the expected way. It's not the richer women who speak up more, it's the poorer women. Now, if one is persuaded by these results, then one can ask, well, how do we enhance women's numbers in these community forestry groups? And by the way, I didn't mention there were 84,000 such groups across India, and there were over 10,000 in Nepal. So we're not talking about small numbers; we're talking about really large numbers. So their presence can make a key difference. What I'm arguing here is that there are two ways by which one can increase participation and voice. One is through horizontal linkages. And here I'm arguing that the way to do it is that there are a large number of self-help groups and other forms of women's groups, and the horizontal linkages could be, say, if you take community forestry groups and self-help groups and link them horizontally. And there are examples in the paper where non-governmental organizations have tried to do precisely that, and it has made a key difference for women to be able to strategize rather than being women in themselves, to actually discuss and strategize and take their issues into the committee. But secondly, we know that a lot of local issues, it's not at all adequate only talk about the local. You have to talk about beyond the local. So if you're talking about energy policy, water policies, technology policy, whatever you're talking about, you have to actually bargain with the state, and you can't do it from the local. So here what I'm arguing is the whole idea of federations. Some of you would be familiar with it. What you have typically is single issue federations. So you have federations of forest user groups in Nepal. Nepal has a countrywide federation of forest user groups. And it really extends beyond just the interests of the local users to some sort of solidarity, if you like, because they participated in the democracy movement in Nepal. And then you have self-help group federations. There were 2.5 million more self-help groups in India. But then here's one. This is a picture of the Nepal FECO Fund, where you have 50% by the constitution of the office bearers need to be women. But here is what I'm finally suggesting, that you can have federations, single-purpose federations, but linking federations with each other could produce the most effectiveness in terms of dealing with the state. So with that, whether we're able to do that or not, but I do want to mention in closing that there are, again, small examples of attempts in parts of India where forest federations and self-help group federations have tried to link up. They are rather small in terms of as being experimental, but they provide enough gist for us to think that this could be a way to go. Thank you.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.